Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Digging in their heels, the standoff deepens between President Biden and Senate Republicans over raising the debt ceiling. Then a major oil spill off the coast of California threatens wildlife as crews race to contain the damage. And back in session, the Supreme Court takes on abortion, gun rights, and more divisive issues in the new term that starts today. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A high-stakes standoff between the president and Senate Republicans is unfolding in Washington over the country's debt limit. It comes just 2 weeks before the United States is set to default on its debt, which could trigger damaging economic consequences for the entire country. Today, President Biden called congressional Republicans' position, quote, dangerous. For more, I am joined by our Yamiche Alcindor, our White House correspondent. So, Yamiche, we heard today both from the president and from the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Where does everything stand?
Well, both sides are dug in as it relates to their stances on the debt ceiling, and it's unclear which side will blink in this standoff. Now, President Biden took to the White House podium today, and he delivered pointed remarks. He accused Republicans of playing, quote, Russian roulette with the U.S. economy. He said that the debt ceiling is not about new spending. He said that this is about whether or not the U.S. will be able to pay its bills. Here's part of what the president had to say.
Not only are Republicans refusing to do their job, they're threatening to use the power, their power, to prevent us from doing our job, saving the economy from a catastrophic event. I think, quite frankly, it's hypocritical, dangerous, and disgraceful.
Now, President Biden also said that it is wrong for Republicans to link the debt ceiling limit and raising the debt limit with his infrastructure plans, though the GOP has said if Democrats can pass the infrastructure plan, that $3.5 trillion plan with only Democratic support, that they should also be able to raise the debt ceiling that way. The president has pushed back on that, pushed back on the idea that it should be done through reconciliation. He also said that Republicans essentially were in the wrong here because this has been a bipartisan endeavor to raise the debt ceiling. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, he took to the Senate floor after the president spoke. Here's what McConnell had to say.
The majority doesn't need our votes. They just want a partisan, they just want a bipartisan shortcut around procedural hurdles they can actually clear on their own. And they want that shortcut so they can pivot right back to partisan spending as fast as possible.
Now, President Biden said that Republicans do not need to give their votes and said all they need to do is make sure not to filibuster. But there is Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell saying that he is essentially going to stand in the way of Democrats trying to raise the debt ceiling. It's also important that Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, he wrote a letter to President Biden today saying that this is really the Democrats' problem to fix.
And just in a word, Yamiche, the last time we looked, there was also disagreement among Democrats over two huge pieces of legislation, reconciliation, and this larger social spending. Any movement on that?
The president's still trying to get his party on the same page. The president today blamed essentially Senators Manchin and Sinema, saying that they were the two Democrats that he couldn't get to really back his plans as of yet. But the president did have a meeting with progressives today saying that they need to come down on that $3.5 trillion price tag for the bipartisan infrastructure bill, I should say rather for the Democrat-backed infrastructure bill. So we'll have to see where those numbers end up. I'm hearing that it's going to be around $2 trillion. But Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says he wants to get all of this done by the end of October. So we'll have to see where this ends. But they're already eyeing the end of the month as trying to get this done.
All right. Yamiche Alcindor following these two major stories. Thank you, Yamiche. In the day's other news, crews in Southern California worked to clean up an oil spill that fouled parts of the coastline over the weekend. Huntington Beach was hit hard after an offshore pipeline leaked 126,000 gallons, closing beaches and killing wildlife. Investigators are looking at whether a ship's anchor ruptured the pipeline. We'll return to this later in the program. Today was the deadline for teachers and staff to get COVID vaccinations in New York City's public school system, the nation's largest. Mayor Bill de Blasio says that 95% of school employees have now had at least one dose. Thousands rushed to get inoculated in the past week to avoid being put on unpaid leave. Refugee admissions to the U.S. hit a record low in the federal fiscal year that just ended. The Associated Press reports just under 11,500 refugees were admitted. That does not include thousands of Afghans who came in recent weeks. President Biden had pledged to reverse the sharp cuts of the Trump years. UN humanitarian officials condemned Libya today for a violent crackdown on migrants trying to sail to Europe. They say security forces rounded up more than 5,100 people and killed at least one since Friday. An estimated 215 children and more than 540 women were among those detained. Other refugee advocates said it is Libya's largest crackdown in recent years.
We're hearing from migrants that we're in touch with that they're scared to leave their homes. We know that their Libyan neighbors have told them, don't leave your homes because it's just not safe. So people are quite horrified.
The UN's Human Rights Council also accused Libya's government today of possible crimes against humanity. It cited violence against migrants and civilians caught up in warfare between rival regimes and militias. Back in this country, the Biden administration reversed a Trump-era ban on abortion referrals by family planning clinics that receive federal funding. The ban had prompted an exodus from the federal program by providers linked with Planned Parenthood. The policy now reverts to what it was in the Obama years. Two Americans are winners of this year's Nobel Prize for Medicine for work that could lead eventually to new non-opioid painkillers. David Julius and Artem Potapudian made breakthroughs years ago, working independently of each other. Their work shows how receptors in the skin respond to heat and pressure. On Wall Street today, the broader market fell as tech stocks dropped. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 323 points, or 1%, to close back near 34,000. The Nasdaq fell 311 points, that's 2%. The S&P 500 slid 56, more than 1%. And oil prices closed near $78 a barrel. That is the highest since 2014. And Star Trek's Captain Kirk is finally heading to space for real. William Shatner, who is now 90 years old, will be a passenger next week on a Blue Origin capsule, the company owned by Amazon's Jeff Bezos. The space travel company invited him on a flight that will last 10 minutes before returning to Earth. Two other passengers will be paying customers. Still to come on the NewsHour, a look at the cases on the Supreme Court docket this term. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter break down the latest political news. A Pakistani musician embraces tradition while charting a new path, and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today, the Biden administration unveiled its long-awaited approach to trade relations with China. U.S. Trade Representative Katherine Tai said that she would restart trade talks with Beijing, but maintain most Trump-era tariffs on China. Nick Schifrin is here to explain. So, Nick, hello. Tell us, what exactly did the U.S. Trade Representative announce?
That Biden will not move away from Trump-era tariffs, will not launch a full-scale negotiation with China, and will instead enforce President Trump's trade deal with China. That trade deal is known as Phase One, in which Beijing promised to buy about $200 billion of American goods. But the Peterson Institute says that China's only bought 62 cents for every $1 it's promised. Ambassador Tai said today that she would hold China accountable to its commitments, but it was very restrained, the criticism, and she took pains not to say that she supported a trade war.
Our analysis indicates that while commitments in certain areas have been met, that certain business interests have seen benefits, there have also been shortfalls in others. Our objective is not to inflame trade tensions with China. Durable coexistence requires accountability and respect for the enormous consequences of our actions.
Ambassador Tai said she would allow U.S. companies to appeal to remove tariffs. The U.S. will try to work more with allies to confront China's trade practices and will try to be more resilient in the U.S., Judy, through its Build Back Better. But ultimately, today was about continuity, maintaining Trump-era tariffs as a tool for economic strategy.
So many businesses watching this very closely. What has been the response so far?
She's been criticized by multiple sides. Some China experts I've spoken to say this is not a strategy. It's a holding pattern born out of fear that any major steps on China is perilous domestically, politically, for the Biden administration. Some of the more hawkish experts I've talked to say this doesn't go far enough, that there's no promised punishment for China not adhering to its promises, nor is there a roadmap to try and get China to make those fundamental changes. But on the other side, businesses have been pushing Biden administration to say that tariffs don't work. And so take a listen to Anna Ashton of the U.S.-China Business Council, who told me she was disappointed.
It's a disappointment to see this focus on the value of tariffs. I don't think that there's been a case made by the Biden administration either today during Ambassador Tai's speech or prior to today that the tariffs have been beneficial in any specific way. And at the same time, we have all of this evidence that's mounted over the course of the last few years that the tariffs have been detrimental to U.S. businesses.
So it seems that Ambassador Tai didn't please very many people, but she kept her cards close to the vest, held back her criticism, and that may give her room in those upcoming talks with Beijing.
And what about Beijing? Have they said anything yet?
They have not said anything to her, but they have responded in the last few days in a very different way. More Chinese planes have flown into Taiwan's self-declared air defense identification zone just outside of Taiwanese airspace than ever before. This is three straight days of record military harassment of Taiwan. Today, Taiwan's foreign minister said he was concerned that Beijing would launch a war, but did not think that war was imminent. But bottom line, Judy, Beijing is flexing its muscles militarily, warning the U.S. and its allies over support for Taiwan. We will soon see whether Beijing will also flex its muscles in trade talks.
Yeah. Connection between the economy and the military. We'll see. Nick Schifrin, thank you.
Thank you.
Federal and state investigators are focusing on a 41-year-old pipeline as the cause of a massive oil spill off the coast of California. The spill is threatening wildlife and prompting a robust cleanup effort in the Pacific. But as Stephanie Tsai reports, the scale and scope of the damage remains unclear.
A calm day on the water betrays an unfolding catastrophe. Some of the first victims, the California coast's ever-present seals, slicked in oil. Booms and skimmers have been deployed to contain and clean up the some 126,000 gallons of oil spilled from an underwater pipeline into the Pacific Ocean on Saturday. Today, officials said oil can be seen overhead from Orange County's Huntington Beach all the way down to Dana Point. Local officials warned some beaches would be closed for weeks or even months. Orange County Supervisor Katrina Foley described the scene to reporters on Sunday.
I was there for a few hours today, and even during that time, I started to feel a little bit of my throat hurt, and you can feel the vapor in the air.
Orange County's health care agency has asked residents to refrain from participating in recreational activities on the coastline, such as swimming, surfing, biking, walking, exercising, and gathering. The area known as Surf City is closed and mostly empty, but for volunteers picking up tar balls.
I'm picking this up and then I'm going to take it to disposal center as much as I can carry right now.
Amplify Energy says they are still trying to locate where on their pipeline the suspected leak occurred. The pipeline began leaking roughly 4 miles off the shore and was shut down on Saturday night. Martin Wilshire is the CEO of Amplify Energy.
We will do everything in our power to ensure that this is recovered as quickly as possible, and we won't be done until this is concluded.
For Californians, the spill is just the latest environmental punch.
Preventing an ecological disaster.
Kim Carr is the mayor of Huntington Beach, where by today the oil had already infiltrated Talbert Marsh, a large ecological reserve.
We are in the midst of a potential ecological disaster. Our wetlands are being degraded, and portions of our coastline are now covered in oil.
Oil spills kill wildlife. Heavy oil can smother animals. And when seabirds get oil in their feathers, the birds can't stay warm. They die of hypothermia. It's one of the worst spills Southern California has seen in recent history. The last major spill was in 2015 near Santa Barbara, when a ruptured pipeline dumped 2,400 barrels on shore and into the ocean. As the cause of this oil spill is investigated, people who live and work near Huntington Beach reported smelling oil as early as Friday, leaving many to ask whether officials responded quickly enough to contain the spill. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
A worldwide consortium of journalists has published what it calls the Pandora Papers, revealing a parallel financial universe in which world leaders and the mega rich can hide billions of dollars in secretive offshore accounts. Investigators say the accounts drain money from government treasuries and can undermine national security and democracy. Nick Schifrin is back with that story.
The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists shared 12 million financial records with 150 news organizations to provide an unprecedented window into how billions are hidden from authorities, investigators, and countries' citizens. Jordan's King Abdullah's advisors created dozens of shell companies to buy homes worth $106 million, despite high poverty levels in Jordan and a corruption crackdown that targets citizens who use shell companies. Today, Jordan's palace said the king's properties were, quote, not unusual nor improper. These properties are not publicized out of security and privacy concerns. In Russia, President Vladimir Putin's alleged girlfriend became the owner of a Monaco apartment through an offshore company. And in the U.S., states have passed secrecy laws that allow tens of millions to be sheltered from view. Joining me to discuss this is Drew Sullivan, co-founder and editor of the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. Drew Sullivan, welcome to the NewsHour. Your organization teamed up with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists to publish these stories. Why do you think secretive offshore accounts are a threat to national security and democracy?
Well, really, opaque money is opaque power. And what, you know, these offshore companies really are is they're a device to move money around the world and to keep it secret. And the problem with that is, you know, it can be money that's stolen, and it can be money, you know, that you're trying to move for some business somewhere. But a lot of times it's really money people are trying to hide, people are trying to launder. And once that money gets into your country, you don't know what it's going to do. It can do something like create a real estate bubble, which, you know, is annoying but not harmful. But it could also fund things like, terrorist groups, extremist political parties, bad actors in your country, terrorists. So, you know, it's in this day and age, we should be able to control the monetization of money in our countries. And we really can't because of this offshore industry.
And one of the more interesting parts of this investigation is that it's not only offshore, is it? It's inside the United States.
It's all over the world. And in the United States, they're proliferating, too. So you have places like South Dakota and Wyoming and Nevada, you know, and a lot of other states considering passing laws. A lot of organized crime gangs that we follow and track are more often using the United States now than they are, you know, someplace like Dubai or something like that. And it's because the United States, a U.S. address, seems to give an indication that that's a legitimate company, and U.S. companies are respected for the transparency. But in fact, you're not getting the transparency. It's being hidden.
As I mentioned before, offshore companies linked to King Abdullah of Jordan have purchased more than $100 million of homes in the U.S. and the U.K. What does his story say to you?
That's really a classic case of a ruler really not wanting their people to know what properties they have, because it'll raise questions as whether it's appropriate to have a $33 million, you know, mansion overlooking Malibu. You know, is that really the best, you know, image for the King of Jordan? And so it basically helps them avoid, you know, the kind of scrutiny and the kind of questions as to whether they're really acting in the interest of their country. But more importantly, you know, increasingly a lot of rulers, and I'm not saying this is about King Abdullah, but, you know, a lot of this money and a lot of other rulers and potentially the king is stolen money, is money that's been paid in bribes. It's money that's paid in, you know, getting a part of a business deal and those types of things. And so they also want to keep those kind of interests and those kind of assets that they're purchasing from that outside of the public and the regulators' you know, purview.
And I also mentioned Vladimir Putin. What does that story say? And what does it say how the Russian authorities have responded to the journalists who have exposed this?
Putin is probably stolen somewhere around $200 billion. And he's one of, you know, the most rapacious rulers in the world in terms of we've studied how he gets kickbacks and steals money for years. And, you know, his system is simply he's going to take what he wants, and anybody who causes problems or raises these issues are crushed. And in fact, just in the last, you know, 4 months or so, most of the large respected investigative reporting organizations in Russia have had to stop publishing in Russia.
This is all out there. Of course, it's being dismissed and denied by the various people in these stories. What's the real-world effect, if any?
Well, there will be some. I mean, there will be people who ask for sanctions. There will be people who will ask for Magnitsky filings, which will basically allow those properties taken away. So, I mean, there's a large civil society world out there that is really trying to police this by using sanctions and seizures of properties to get the money back for the citizens of those countries. And you'll see that, you know, especially in the most egregious cases like Azerbaijan, you know, where they have $700 million worth of property in London. I mean, that's obscene. And I think you'll see a lot of people going after those public interest law firms trying to get these assets taken away.
Drew Sullivan, thank you very much.
Great to be here, Nick. Thanks.
The Supreme Court returned to the courtroom this morning to hear its first oral arguments of what looks to be an unusually consequential new term. John Yang has more.
Judy, the Supreme Court term began this morning with familiar words from Chief Justice John Roberts.
I have the honor to announce on behalf of the court that the October 2020 term of the Supreme Court of the United States is now closed. And the October 2021 term is now convened.
But even though the justices, most of them at least, were back in person, not much else seemed the same as when they were last in the courtroom in March 2020. And the cases set for argument this term could make it one of the most contentious in many years. Marcia Coyle, chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal, was one of the two dozen or so reporters back in the courtroom this morning, and she is back in the studio now.
John, yes.
Marcia, so what was it like? What was it like this morning?
Well, you know, John, it was normal and it was abnormal. It was normal in the fact that there were justices actually on the bench and they were hearing oral arguments, but it was abnormal. First days at the Supreme Court, you usually have a court building that's full of tourists on the lower level, lines of people who are waiting to get seats in the courtroom, lines of lawyers in suits waiting to be sworn into the bar, and the whole floor seems to be humming with talk. But today, silence. A few Supreme Court police officers, a few staff people, you know, going in and out of offices, everybody masked. You go into the courtroom and you see the press. Those of us who attended, we were in the public seats, not in the usual press section, but in public seats so that we could be spread out, and we were masked. And also, the lawyers who were going to argue, they were limited to having only one other lawyer with them before you could have that table full of a team of lawyers, also masked. in the guest section for the justices, there really was hardly anybody there, but Justice Kennedy, retired Justice Kennedy, showed up in mask. Justice Breyer's wife was there in a mask. And Justice Barrett's husband also showed up masked, and they were appropriately distanced. So it was strange. And then during the arguments, as you mentioned, they were all on the bench except for Justice Kavanaugh, who last week was positive for COVID and is staying out of the arguments this week. But he was participating remotely. So you had this disembodied voice echoing in the courtroom when he did ask questions. The only justice who wore a mask was Justice Sotomayor, and I think because of being extra cautious since she is a diabetic. So, you know, it was strange, and then it wasn't strange.
And it's a big term for this court. I mean, there's hardly a hot-button issue that they are not considering this term, including the most divisive of all, abortion.
That's right, John. And who knows? There may be two abortion cases getting to the court. There's still action in the lower courts on the Texas ban at 6 weeks of pregnancy. So it's not only abortion; it's guns. They've taken up a case that could result in the expansion of gun rights under the Second Amendment. They've also taken two religion-related cases: one that deals with separation of church and state, one involving a death row inmate who wants to have his minister present in the death chamber but praying and laying on hands. So yes, you're absolutely right. And they could add to that easily. Pending is a big affirmative action case involving Harvard. The court continues to accept cases until about mid-January. And then usually they have about 70 for arguments. And right now, I think the number is about 39. So this term could grow yet.
And in this first week on Wednesday, there's a case involving state secrets.
That's right, John. In fact, it's one of two state secrets cases, which is really unusual. The court hasn't looked at the state secrets doctrine for a long time. The first case that is on Wednesday, it involves somebody who is now at Guantanamo Bay, but he is trying to get evidence, what we call discovery of evidence from former federal contractors who were involved in his interrogation when he was at a CIA back site in Poland. This detainee was seriously interrogated. In fact, they say he has suffered brain damage and the loss of one eye. The government is saying you can't have that evidence because it will expose national security to danger. The court has got to take a look at that. And then there's another case that involves three Muslim men from California, I believe, who feel that they were, that the FBI was surveilling them because of their religion. And again, they want information, and the government has pleaded the state secrets doctrine. So yes, and then there's also a very important death penalty, the Boston Marathon bomber. His sentence was invalidated by a federal appellate court because of errors at trial, and the justices have agreed to look at those trial errors and see if the lower court was correct in what it did. So, yeah, it's a huge term, huge.
In recent weeks, we've had a number of justices give public remarks, all sort of defending the court against a lot of criticism from the public. What's going on here?
John, I think it's a reaction to the court's more recent rulings on emergency applications that come to it. It's generally known as the court's shadow docket. And those rulings have come in very controversial areas, such as the Texas abortion ban, the Biden administration's effort to extend the ban on evictions, as well as the Remain in Mexico immigration policy of the Trump administration. And so I think some of the justices are voicing concerns about the impact of this criticism of the court, and maybe also have an eye on the fact that this is a very controversial term. The public's going to be watching, and so they're worried what the public's going to react to the decisions that may be coming forward.
Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal, who will be helping us keep an eye on the term ahead. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, John.
Facebook and its group of apps and social media channels went down for most of this day. William Brangham looks at the latest, all of it coming on the eve of another difficult congressional hearing for the social media giant.
That's right, Judy. Facebook's app and its website, along with Instagram and WhatsApp, went dark for several hours today, and at this moment, they appear to be slowly coming back up. The cause of the outages still haven't been explained, but for the more than 3 billion people in the United States and abroad who use these apps to communicate and to do business, these outages were a huge disruption and a reminder of these apps' influence. Shira Frankel of the New York Times reports on Facebook extensively and has been following this all day. She's the co-author of An Ugly Truth, Inside Facebook's Battle for Domination. Shira, great to have you back on the NewsHour. Can you help us understand what is it that happened today?
So starting at about 9 a.m. Pacific today out here in California, Facebook and its family of apps went down. That includes Instagram, WhatsApp, Oculus. These are platforms that, as you said, impact over 3.5 billion people. And for several hours, no one, including the security engineers at Facebook, knew what was going on. This was amplified by the fact that Facebook's own internal communications were down. So it wasn't just that we couldn't access Facebook.com. Facebook engineers couldn't get into their own emails, and they couldn't even access their own buildings in many cases.
Is there any evidence, I mean, this is what we always think of when these kinds of things happen nowadays, that this was a hack of some kind?
At this point in time, we don't see evidence that this was a hack. We spoke to nearly a dozen engineers that are working within Facebook, many of them directly, to fix this. And they said that it's extremely unlikely that a hack would be able to have this kind of impact, that it would take down all these Facebook apps at the same time. What was a lot more likely and what seems to have happened was that it was an internal update rolled out by Facebook that just went very badly, and which it took them many, many hours to try and fix.
Okay, for the skeptics out there who say, why are we even paying attention to this? Can you just remind us of the stakes here that billions of people use these apps and they're not just teenagers sharing pictures and videos of their friends?
Absolutely. Well, we hope they're not just teenagers sharing pictures of them and their friends, given all the reporting the Wall Street Journal did last week on the effect of Instagram on teenagers. Facebook is largely used by businesses all over the world. We have to remember that in countries ranging from Sri Lanka to Myanmar to Indonesia, Facebook is the way people do business. And WhatsApp is a way that people do business. We spoke to shop owners all over the world today who said that their businesses were effectively shut down because people could not get to their Facebook pages and because they could not use WhatsApp to message people. We also spoke to people who couldn't reach family members, who couldn't reach elderly family members in other parts of the world because WhatsApp was down. So this is something that people use. It is practically a utility in many parts of the world and in many people's lives.
And as you say, that Facebook in many places is in some places a stand-in for the internet, is the vehicle by which people get onto the internet. This comes, for people who've been paying attention to this, at an incredibly inopportune moment for Facebook. We saw last night on 60 Minutes, a whistleblower came forward who you referenced, who's been arguing that Facebook has not been doing enough to tamp down on some of the what it knows to be damaging impact that its website has on teenagers. This also comes after a year plus of scrutiny about their behavior and whether they've cracked down on hate and misinformation that you reported in your book. And then hearing coming tomorrow on Capitol Hill. I mean, this is, they are in the crosshairs as much as possible on the very day that their website goes down.
You couldn't really think of worse timing as far as Facebook is concerned for people to be going to Google and Twitter and putting in there what is wrong with Facebook or what is the problem with Facebook, because they're going to come back with hundreds of articles that were written in the last week pointing to really deep systemic problems within Facebook. You just touched on many of those in your question. The ways in which Instagram is bad for teenagers, the way in which Facebook as a platform has promoted hate speech and misinformation. These are things that journalists have been writing about for years, and as you noted, which we covered in our book, which came out this summer. But we now have a whistleblower who's come forward with internal documents showing that Facebook was sitting on research showing just how bad the platform was, just how many harms the platform was causing. And despite that research, they continued to make decisions which amplified hate speech, which increased the amount of misinformation people saw, and which marketed their product towards teenagers, which we know are incredibly sensitive to the harms of Instagram.
I know that this is not air traffic control. This is not missile defense. This is not a hospital. But as you said, there are plenty of examples in which Facebook is a vital ability for people to get onto the internet. But it is a little bit alarming, I think, is fair to say, that something as simple as this glitch that you're describing, that could be what happened here, could take down such a central part of the internet.
Absolutely. And I think it shows us the danger of Facebook having such a large role to play in the infrastructure of the internet. I mean, one thing I hadn't said before, which people should also consider, is that many people use Facebook to log into other apps. They use it to log into their smart home systems, like their smart TVs or even their smart thermostats. So when Facebook went down, people couldn't access basic things around their house. I mean, this is a mega internet company that touches on so many different aspects of your lives. And in some way, it takes Facebook going down in this really sort of catastrophic and immense way for people to understand just how many parts of their lives this company touches on.
Indeed. Shira Frankel, always good to see you from the New York Times. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Stare downs in Washington on the debt ceiling and the Biden agenda have left President Biden working to keep the country from defaulting on its debt and to bring Democrats together over government spending priorities. Here to talk about it all, our Politics Monday team, Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. Hello to both of you on this Monday. Good to see you. So let's just dive right in. Tam, it was our lead story tonight, this standoff between President Biden and the Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell pointing fingers at each other over something that we know has to be raised. The debt ceiling, it can't sit where it is. It has to go up. So what is this all about?
Every time there is a debt ceiling fight, there are fingers pointed everywhere. And it's all about spending that has already happened. This isn't about spending that's coming in the future. This is allowing us to pay our bills as a country. But President Biden and Mitch McConnell have now, you know, exchanged letters and words, and they are not seemingly looking for a path out of this. They're both dug in. The question is, does the public care? Maybe not right now. If the U.S. defaults on its debt, the public will suddenly care a lot, and then they'll start wondering whose fault it was. And right now, they're pointing in opposite directions, trying to make sure that the other one gets the blame.
So Right. Some people look at this as political games, but there are real consequences.
There are real consequences here for this stare down if both of them refuse to blink. But to Tam's point, this has been going on for so long that even the markets have now sometimes, although today I think there was a little blip, but even they have sort of assumed that, look, this is just gamesmanship and eventually this is going to get worked out. This is just a political process. But there are real consequences. And the real challenge right now is that the president himself and his party, well, they're the ones in charge. And so when it comes to the blame game, Democrats, Tam is correct, they will say to Republicans, hey, this is pretty hypocritical, you guys not allowing a vote on this, considering the fact that you voted on it when Donald Trump was president. And also, we're paying for a lot of the programs you all voted for. That's what we're doing. But Republicans will say, you know what? And this is what they are saying. We don't like this $3.5 trillion package you're putting together. And if we give you a vote on the debt ceiling, it's basically saying we're okay with this amount of spending, which we're not. And guess what? Democrats, you have the votes. You go ahead and do it. You don't want to do it because you don't want to take the tough votes. And it, by the way, just one more quick thing. It drags out this process for the president's agenda, and Democrats are so eager to be done with this.
But meanwhile, Tam, I mean, we remember it wasn't that many decades ago that Joe Biden and Mitch McConnell were actually able to work together on a few things.
It wasn't even decades ago. In fact, they even worked together to settle a previous debt ceiling dispute. Right. And it's possible they'll figure it out this time. But McConnell is taking this hard line, essentially saying that Republicans are going to filibuster a clean debt ceiling increase. He wants Democrats to have to completely own it, to do this procedural thing called reconciliation, which we've been talking about a lot for President Biden's Build Back Better agenda. But they want them to use this thing that will draw more attention to the debt ceiling being raised, will take time, will take floor time in the Senate. The White House is saying, oh, it's risky to do that because what if it takes too long? But having it take too long, I think, is part of the goal for Mitch McConnell to really make Democrats own this and not just vote on it quickly, you know, late
at
night.
That's right.
Can one side get or another, Amy, get badly burned by this, or does it just pass and we look back and there they go again?
And there they go again. I mean, I do think the public is definitely frustrated in seeing both sides. Nobody has a clean bill of health on the hypocrisy scale, right, or whatever. I mixed a lot of metaphors there, but I think you know where I'm going. But as I said, the party in power gets all the blame. And so the president himself, we've been talking a lot these past few weeks about the fact that he's been struggling politically. He needs a big win. People don't understand what this is all about. The president will take the blame when things go poorly.
And of course, this isn't the only headache the president is dealing with right now, Tam. What we spent so many hours thinking about, talking about last week, the division among Democrats over infrastructure and over this bigger social spending bill. What happens if this just drags on?
Well, this is going to just drag on. Yeah. They're talking about Halloween. President Biden has previously talked about Christmas as sort of the informal deadline in his mind. This was sort of a self-imposed deadline on Thursday that they missed to vote on the bipartisan infrastructure plan. The reality, which has been sort of clear but was crystallized by last week, is that Democrats have to figure out how to agree amongst themselves on the whole thing, the big the Build Back Better and the bipartisan infrastructure plan. They have to agree on all of it, and they don't yet. There have been passed big bills that looked like they just weren't going to happen. You know, the Republican tax cut under President Trump, the Affordable Care Act under President Obama. And round about Christmas time, things that seemed impossible suddenly were like, oh, why did we think that wouldn't happen?
Right. It's a mouthful. But I mean, could it really, Amy, go on that long?
Yes. And it probably will. I think the end of October is way too optimistic. So it is probably the end of the year. And just to appreciate what Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are dealing with here, going back to some of those votes, or I go all the way back to the 90s with Bill Clinton, you know, Clinton lost about 40 Democrats in the House on his big reconciliation bill. Trump lost 13 Republicans on that tax bill that Tam was referring to. Nancy Pelosi can afford three defections. Three. Obama lost 40 something votes on healthcare, on Obamacare. So she has literally no room for error, which is where this started at the very beginning. We've known all along a 50-50 Senate, three seat margin in the House. This cannot you can't sort of like just muscle this through. This is precision legislating.
Democrats hold all the levers of power, but they barely have a grasp on any of them.
That's right.
Very quickly, and not much time left, but I really want to ask you about what John Yang was talking to Marcia Coyle about, and that is the Supreme Court term starting today. They've got a number of high-profile cases coming up, including Mississippi abortion law that would allow, it essentially tightens the restrictions around abortions. And then we've, of course, just seen the Supreme Court uphold the Texas law that permits regular people to sue abortion providers. We looked at a poll that this is the Marist poll that the NewsHour does with NPR. Both of them are not liked by a majority of Americans. Look at this. 74% of Americans say they don't agree with the legal action by private citizens. 58% don't like this so-called cardiac activity law. I mean, this is, Tam, my question is, it's not just something that the courts have to worry about. The public is invested in this politically.
And yet, there is no political mechanism in America to have a referendum, to have the will of the people. And there's no such thing as settled law. There's precedent, there's super precedent, but those things can change over time. And that is what is potentially happening here.
Yeah. And the question, too, is does that translate into voting behavior? In other words, how salient is that issue for voters who may disapprove of many of these things, but they say, you know what, coronavirus, the COVID, you know, issue is my number one priority. The economy is my number one priority. This is important to me, but not as important as those other things. We're not going to really understand where the salience is until first we see the rulings, but then also understand where we are come next fall.
Which voters could get motivated by
that's
whatever
right.
happens.
That's right.
Amy Walter, Tamara Key, thank you both.
You're welcome.
The South Asian art form known as Sufi music has a centuries-old tradition built on poetry and mysticism, coupled with specific instruments, meters, and repetition. One Brooklyn-based Pakistani musician is steeped in that history, yet also going her own way, refusing to let others define her work. Special correspondent Tom Cachado has our story as part of the Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
Aruj Aftab recently debuted work from her latest album at a concert at Brooklyn's Pioneer Works. Her compositions are personal, her performance intimate, but it was far from a solo effort.
The way that I like to kind of produce this music is leaving space for the band. We're all involved in telling a story from this moment the song starts until the very end.
Still, the band is executing a vision of which she is in command.
To even actually conceptualize a band like that is a creative work. Especially a singer-composer who doesn't actively play an instrument, there is this sentiment in the industry of like kind of discrediting women for the work that they do. You have to kind of overstate that you're not just a singer, you are also the composer, you're also the producer, you're also the arranger.
She's also unwilling to let others define her. She sings mostly in Urdu, her lyrics drawn from poetry often centuries old. Her music draws from seemingly everywhere. For example, she'll bring non-traditional instruments like synthesizer and lever harp to a traditional South Asian poetic form like the ghazal. She's even given her style its own name, Neo-Sufi.
It's not South Asian classical music with like fused with jazz. It's like it's living in its own world of like a marriage of many roots and heritages. So I was kind of like, I need to like name this right now.
Take a hold of it.
Yeah.
Writing of her recent album, Vulture Prince, the music site Pitchfork said she has as much acclaim to the Western traditions of jazz and experimental electronica as to the folk and classical music of her homeland. The album is dedicated to her younger brother, Maher, who passed away in 2018.
When it's a younger sibling, it's almost like you're kind of, if they're young enough, you know, you kind of raised them too. So it's like such a weird sort of loss.
Her loss and her art converge in a composition called Diahe, its lyrics derived from a poem by the popular 19th century Indian poet Mirza Ghalib.
And I loved the poem itself, but it took me a really long time to actually like make it mine. When I was workshopping it and trying to figure it out, like I was in Pakistan and I was hanging out with Maher, and so it's the last thing that I really sang to him. And so that kind of felt important to me that I should really just like figure it out and put it in the record.
There was a time as a teenager in Lahore, Pakistan, when it looked like she would never make a record.
Were your parents okay with you wanting to be a musician?
I think they were like, that's not gonna work out for you, you know, like that you're not gonna make any money. What are you saying? You wanna be famous?
Still, she had the self-assurance to take on a poet of more recent vintage, Leonard Cohen, and his celebrated composition, Hallelujah.
I think no one believed in me at the time, and I really wanted I wanted people to believe that I'm good at music.
Hallelujah. She Was More Than Good. Aftab's version of Hallelujah went viral in Pakistan. It also helped fuel an ambition she revealed to her parents.
And I was like, well, there's this college, it's called Berklee, and I will get a bachelor's degree and I will study audio engineering and jazz. And they were like, oh, okay, so somebody's organized this for us. Fine, you know, let's do it.
Accepted to Boston's prestigious Berklee College of Music, Aftab moved to the States in 2005. She kept at her goal of becoming a professional musician, but got her degree in music production and engineering.
I felt that I needed some sort of like concrete industry skill. I came out of Berklee in like 2008 or 9, moved to New York, super recession times. All the music studios were kind of closing. People were making all these products that you could record at home. So it was just like, oh great. No, they don't need audio engineers anymore.
Audio engineering's loss was composing's gain. Where else would we get a song like Last Night, with lyrics adapted from 13th century Sufi mystic and poet Rumi, put to a beat like this one? Was even brighter
than the sun. I really liked the idea of juxtaposing Rumi with a reggae groove, but also kind of jazz, upright bass vibes, and then like adding this sort of Urdu meter in the middle.
There's just a whole world of things you just talked about in half a sentence. Let's just go back for a minute.
I was reading a lot of Rumi, you know, I was also listening to a lot of reggae. In a jam, like those two things kind of came together.
I'm not sure they've ever come together before. It's not like, you know, those Rumi reggae tunes that everyone does. Right.
Aftab says for her next album, she'd like to explore the writings of a medieval Indian ruler and warrior called Chand Bibi.
She was one of the only and first female feminist warrior politician badass who like released an anthology of poems. I like the fact that her work has never been put to song.
And do you relate to feminist badass warriors?
I think so. I think that, you know, we all probably came from her.
Maybe that's where Aruj Aftab came from. Where she's taking her audience is somewhere new. I'm Tom Cachotto for the PBS NewsHour in Brooklyn, New York.
Such a wonderful story. And on the NewsHour online right now, a family-owned Louisiana grocery store, open for 107 years, has weathered numerous storms. But damage from Hurricane Ida has the community wondering whether this local staple can bounce back. That's on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.